Irish epic poem in 33 cantos, read by the poet Paul O'Mahony. Canto 31. The black robes are shamed, tabernacle rent, the host is exposed to fire. All the churches of Ireland have been burnt to the ground. The people are eating the bishops, spitting out grit grizzle. Every rosary beads has been snapped. The altar wine used to marinate tongues slashed out. I saw one priest survive, as the archbishop was given a last chance to understand his tears wouldn't well. He offered his testicles, tried to reason with the victim of the mass kidnapping his brothers had orchestrated. Before they were wiped out, the nuns took confession. They knew the words by heart, knew that penance was auto-generated. Many of the priests went rushing to eternal damnation, shouting, "I desire limbo! Reinvent it! Hell is too good for my soul! I've been Lucifer's minister, sent by Beelzebub, child of the unthinkable, unspeakable. I knew we made bishops of savage men who were never baptized except by the water of the gutter. Burn me! I too knew bishops were promoted to lead the ring. We invented a method of snuffing out your children's games because we loved the passion of envy. The stations of the tosspot. We were inspired by the joy of pain, the ritual of flagellation. Opus Dei was but a secret society, a fall guy, a handy distraction to deflect attention from our true vocation. John Charles McQuaid claimed he discussed his mental reservation with Michael Collins and Winston Churchill. We knew it was Dev. He was pulling the crozier on." All the oblates died quickly. Christian brothers claimed they weren't priests, but no one swallowed that. Who saw the nun rubbing incense into the skin of parish priest in Donegal before he was fried alive in goose fat? All the clergy that had stayed silent were given the option of being dunked in honey and fed to specially starved pigs, or being fed little rats bred to feed on intestines. I saw a convent dedicated to smoked priest on apple wood. There are no faithful now. The Book of Kells was a casualty. "Bring back the catechism," the young ones cried. "We'll write the answers this time." The crowd insisted no guillotine was used. Hanging, drawing and quartering was the merciful way to go. Only the most recent convents were granted this privilege. It was as if Dante was a stroll in the park and Job beset by a minor irritant that was pure savage shock and awe. Munch's scream cubed to the power of 10, to the power of the number of stars that chatter in the night sky. No poet, even Kavanagh, could do it justice. That happened after prime time on the national television station. The only religious staff left in Ireland after that were reverend mothers and their sisters. An awful lot of them knitted their way through the reign of terror, the rising of the moon, as it came to be called. "Is there anyone there?" said the strangler, flopping against the back of the pub, and his car on the corner, its engine off, clamped, the tax not paid, and a crow flew up and out of the eaves above the strangler's head. And he rose against the door again a second time. "Is there anyone there?" he said, but no one attended to the strangler. It was past closing time, and they locked the world outside. The business of dividing the spoils had begun. One less would be no harm. "We are the honest men. We are the purchased men, loaning together, half-castes filled with pride, alas. Our wise voices, when we present together, are loud and meaningful, as sand in hourglass, or stag's feet over bracken leaves in our grand estate. Tone without edge, plumes without flow, sustaining force, character with style. Those who have passed with suspect eyes to life's lesser wealth forget us, if only known as soft, genteel souls, but never as the honest men, the purchased men." A tall fellow from Offaly, in a pink-striped suit, fresh from the gym, opened proceedings. He played with a cigar in his left pocket and gently stroked the slight trace of growth from the long day he'd had on the phone to his broker. "Although it is a fierce evening down by one of the horse boxes, an old jock sits tending his boots, in the shadows almost invisible, a tricolour shirt, and his racing stick with lost tongue. I tell you, this depression is the new black." "Sure the person who takes the first stone out of the way is responsible for the avalanche." "Is that where you got the strike?" "Strike? Shopping?" "Let's put Newry to bed, for Christ's sake," came from behind the bar, the curly one cleaning glasses. "I used to work up there. It was always a bit of Tijuana, full of fellas with their striped diesel." "Because I could not stop for a drink, she kindly stopped for me. The pint glass held, but just ourselves and bestiality. It's about time you paid your respects to your elders and betters. Poetry is an act of memory and the ritual of giving a remarkable funeral to words. I too was invented. I wasn't born, designed, fit for purpose. Accident, accident, accident. That's what it is. You have forgotten me, overlooked my job of keeping you to the straits and narrows of outrageous fortune. Once more, I appeal for Endlinian, poetic minions essential to the feast. You've been at it as if your job was to write a new inferno. Cut out all this blank stuff. Verse with your heart, not head. Give us the music of syllables, paired like white and black notes at the dance. Poetry is light motif, not a surface tune of rhyming couplets. Go to Dickinson's world, climb into her attic, open a package. Any cluster will do. Look how she places her dashes and what she doesn't say. Bring back the silence. Why do you think poets invented empty space if it wasn't to celebrate the sound of letters growing? It's not that they're lazy, that they have an aversion to completing the line, that they need margins to think or fill the time between opening and closing. Poets simply fill it better, spending more time taking away than adding in. Remember Ezra Pound? What did he do with all the wasteland? If you could find a scalpel like that, you could reduce the epic to a haiku.
Moleskine's eye flickered. He lifted his pagemaker back to the page and went back to receiving writing, as he'd done from the beginning. This was the seventh pen that had contributed, a biro from doylecollection.com. The Mont Blanc was missing. I had no idea where I put it. It was a huge loss. I reached over and opened my John Russia man bag, removed Mr. Tato, the man inside the jacket, onto the counter. I could see Nelson's pillar standing, and the number 4 bus with bicycles behind on O'Connell Street in Dublin, before the explosion. 1966, the year of the dog, or the rat, or the year a Jesuit forced me to stand and read German in front of the class, while he massaged the underside of my jaw each time I stumbled in pronunciation. Mr. Tato with his red jacket, striped trousers and flashy hat. I'd been jaundiced too, but it was miles from Moore Street I was reared, without a granny, and no talk of the great famine. But I had more brothers at home, and I was older. When President Kennedy came to the race course in Limerick and mixed up fast horses with beautiful women, there were no Tatos for him. The factory in Coolock wasn't ready. There are no photographs of JFK on a haystack with Guinness on salt and vinegar. The volume I had beside me was from Ennis Diamond, a corner shop across the way from the Falls Hotel. It was irresistible. I would let the universe guide me, open the book wherever nature decreed. I would read the runes as if they were tea leaves from a cup poured by Daisy, the woman who loved me. Even the day I dropped the uncle's car keys in the rainwater barrel. I can see. A contribution arising from the sale of this book will be donated to AWARE, a face helping to defeat depression. I could see it was like sand fighting tide, procrastinating. I rushed to reconsider the risk of opening a page and finding it full of the dishonest men, the hollow men, bloated on potato crisps. What if Mr. Tato's friends included Charlie Haughey or Paddy Power? Would that force me down a blind alley just when I needed inspiration most? End of Canto 31.